Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story.
Ireland Crimes and Mysteries is presented by Go Loud, Ireland's leading audio publisher and the home of Irish podcasts. Find new episodes on the podcast first on the Go Loud app and on your favourite podcast platform.
Let's get an update on Jill Maher's disappearance now. We're joined by Lisa Maximovic, who's outside the shop where that CCTV footage was taken early on Saturday morning. Lisa, good morning to you. Police poring over that video this morning to try to find any clues to Jill's disappearance.
That's right, Michael, and it will help retrace her final steps. And just to illustrate what we know of her final movements, we know that she crossed the road after leaving Bar Etiquette with her friends. She walked north on Sydney Road until she got to this store, a bridal boutique store, and CCTV footage captured her at this point being approached by a man. They spoke for about 40 to 45 seconds, which police said seemed casual by appearance, that possibly they didn't know each other and were engaging in casual conversation. She continued to walk past his door after speaking to him for 40 to 45 seconds and stopped here, got out her phone, seemed to be fumbling around with it, and police say she might have then been speaking to her brother in Perth. But once she took her final steps past the boutique store, she's not been seen since, and police are hoping that this CCTV footage and people coming forward, perhaps as eyewitnesses, will help piece together her last movements.
On the 30th of October 1982, a little girl was born in Drogheda, County Louth. Her name was Gillian McKeown, though everyone knew her as Jill. She spent her earliest years in the seaside village of Termefecken, just north of Drogheda, in a close-knit family with her parents George and Edith McKeown and her brother Michael. When Jill was still a child, the McKeowns made a huge move. George's work took him to Perth, Australia, and the family relocated there for several years. Jill attended Bull Creek Primary School and later Ross Moyne High School, adapting quickly to life on the other side of the world. Those who knew her then remembered her as a lively, outgoing girl who made friends easily. By 1996, the McKeowns had returned home to Ireland. Jill was a teenager by this stage and she fitted back into life in Drogheda. She went to Drogheda Grammar School and later St Oliver's Community College, where she stood out for her wit, energy and sociable nature. Teachers recalled a bright student with a streak of independence, someone who could be both mischievous and deeply caring. Her education continued at University College Dublin, where she completed a Bachelor of Arts degree. It was during these years that Jill began to think seriously about a career in broadcasting. After graduation, she found work with RTE, Ireland's national broadcaster. Colleagues later described her as quick, funny and generous with her time, the kind of person who made a workplace warmer. It was around this time that she met the man who would change her life. In November 2001, Jill was introduced to Tom Marr by a mutual friend named Kira. Tom would later recall in his victim impact statement that their first meeting was awkward. Jill had injured her hand in what he described as a characteristically clumsy fashion, and it was bandaged up when they shook hands. But from that simple introduction, a relationship began. The two grew close and would go on to spend nearly 7 years together before marrying. On the 28th of July 2008, Jill and Tom married in County Wicklow. Their wedding reception was held at Glenview Hotel, nestled in the Glen of the Downs. Family and friends remembered it as a day of sunshine, laughter and hope for the future. Jill's natural warmth and her sense of fun shone through. For her parents, George and Edith, and for her brother, it was a day of pride, watching Jill begin a new chapter of her life with the man she loved. In 2009, Jill and Tom moved to Melbourne, Australia. For Jill, it was a return to the country where she had once gone to school as a little girl. But this time, it was as a young woman, setting out to build her own life. she quickly found work at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. Her colleagues there remembered her as witty, intelligent, stylish, and always great company. Her mother, Edith, later described her daughter as empathetic and determined, though also a little messy, fond of quirky fashion, and what she affectionately called crazy shoes. By the age of 29, Jill Maher had a family who adored her in Ireland, a husband who loved her in Australia, and a career in broadcasting that suited her talents. She was someone who left an impression on people, a warm, funny and loyal friend, a daughter, a sister who never lost her Irish roots, and a woman who carried her life between two countries with ease. By 2012, Jill and Tom were settled in Melbourne's inner north. Jill worked, as I said, at the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and had quickly become part of the radio team's social circle. Colleagues described a workplace where people knew each other well, stayed back to chat after shifts, and sometimes carried that into Friday evenings in Brunswick, the kind of routine that makes a new city feel like home. Friday, the 21st of September 2012, was one of those nights when everything felt ordinary. The working week was over and Jill joined her colleagues from ABC Radio for after-work drinks on Sydney Road in Brunswick. It was a familiar routine. The team often wound down together at the end of a long week of broadcasting. They began the night at the Brunswick Green, a relaxed bar with a leafy courtyard and a mix of regulars and local musicians. The mood was easygoing. Jill chatted with co-workers, laughed and checked her phone occasionally. Later, the group drifted a few doors down to Bar Etiquette, a small cocktail bar that was popular with locals who worked nearby. The crowd there was friendly, the music low enough for conversation, and the atmosphere was warm. Brunswick on a Friday night was busy, but safe. It was the kind of area where trams would rattle past, people spilled onto the footpaths with takeaway coffees or late-night chips, and everyone seemed to know someone on the street. Jill was comfortable there. She and Tom lived only 5 minutes away in an apartment off Lux Way, just behind Hope Street. She knew the route home well. As the night drew to a close, a couple of her colleagues offered Jill a lift home. But she waved them off with a smile. She told them not to worry, her apartment was only a few minutes' walk away. Jill then said her goodbyes to the rest of her colleagues and left Bar Etiquette at around 1:30 a.m., walking north along Sydney Road towards home. It was a mild night in Melbourne as she walked down that familiar street she knew well. By this time, it was around 1:35 a.m. As she was walking, Jill made a brief phone call to her brother Michael back home in Ireland. They spoke about their father who had recently been unwell. The call lasted only a minute or so just enough to check in before she continued her walk. Phone records would later confirm the time of that call, helping police to pinpoint her movements. Sydney Road was still lively even at 1:30 in the morning. A few bars were closing up and late-night trams still rolled through. Cameras from businesses along the street captured fragments of her journey. One shows her crossing the road, another catches her passing a convenience store. In every frame, she appears steady and calm, not disoriented or in distress. Simply just a young lady walking home after a night out. At approximately 1:41 to 1:42 a.m., a CCTV camera inside Dutch's Boutique, a bridal shop at 441 Sydney Road, happened to have a clear view through its front windows. It recorded Jill walking north, past the shop, before she was approached by a man wearing a blue hoodie. The two spoke briefly. The footage had no sound, but it's clear that Jill paused and turned slightly towards him. The interaction appeared casual at first glance. Nothing in her body language suggested she felt threatened. And then she continued walking north, with the man following moments later. That short clip would later become the defining piece of evidence in the case. When police released it to the public a few days later, the man's image, the blue hoodie, and the moment he steps towards Jill would be seen across millions of screens in Australia and in Ireland. Investigators would later confirm that Jill's phone signal cut out shortly after that moment, somewhere near Hope Street, the point where she was last seen on the camera. For detectives, those final steps provided the narrow but crucial window they needed to reconstruct her final movements. When Tom woke up later that morning, Jill still wasn't home. Her side of the bed was empty and her phone wasn't there. At first, he tried not to panic. There were the explanations anyone would reach for. Maybe she'd decided to stay with a colleague after a late night, or perhaps she'd fallen asleep on a couch and would be home soon. As the hours passed, that sense of calm began to fade. Tom started ringing around. First her friends from work, then anyone she might have seen the night before. None of them had heard from her. They confirmed she'd left Bar Etiquette at around 1:30 alone, saying she was walking home. By mid-morning, Tom began retracing her route on foot. He walked along Sydney Road, calling her mobile again and again, checking the laneways and the side streets she would have taken, and even stopping into shops and cafes to ask if anyone had seen her. There was no trace of her. When she still hadn't appeared by lunchtime, Tom contacted Victoria Police. Officers from the Brunswick station arrived at their apartment soon after. They asked routine questions, what she'd been wearing, where she'd gone, whether she'd seemed upset or distracted before leaving work. Tom showed him a recent photo, and within hours, a formal missing person report was filed. Police took the case seriously from the outset. Jill was responsible, close to her husband and family, and not someone who disappeared without word. Detectives began working quickly to establish her last known movements, mapping out the walk from Etiquette Bar to the couple's home in Lux Way, just behind Hope Street. Officers called for anyone who had been on the street after 1 a.m. to contact them and canvassed the area and began collecting CCTV footage from nearby businesses, a step that would soon prove crucial. Meanwhile, Tom did everything he could to keep her name and image in circulation. He printed missing posters, contacted local media and gave statements appealing for anyone who had been on the Sydney Road in the early hours of Saturday morning to come forward. He also phoned Jill's family in Ireland to tell them she was missing, a call no one ever expects to make. The ABC amplified the appeal. So did the Irish media, as the news spread back home to Drogheda and Termefecken. That first day ended with growing concern and no real answers. Jill had simply vanished on a short, familiar walk home. In the days that followed, the search for Jill intensified. What began as a missing persons case quickly became a citywide effort. Detectives from the Brunswick station were joined by members of the homicide squad, and volunteers handed out flyers bearing Jill's photograph across the northern suburbs. Posters went up in cafe windows, on tram stops and outside pubs. Her face was suddenly everywhere. On Monday the 24th of September, a local resident walking through a laneway off Hope Street spotted a handbag lying near a brick wall. Inside were Jill's credit cards, cosmetics and ABC identification. The resident handed it to the police, who sealed off the area. What made the discovery so puzzling was that the laneway had already been searched in the early stages of the investigation, leading officers to wonder whether the bag had been placed there later. The find became an important clue, and the forensic team photographed, fingerprinted and bagged every item. That same day, detectives continued door-to-door operations, speaking to residents along Sydney Road and the adjoining side streets. They asked about any cars parked unusually late, loud noises or strangers seen between 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. Officers continued collecting hours of CCTV footage from shops, service stations, tram cameras and bars. Analysts at the Victoria Police Media Centre worked around the clock, logging every frame and trying to plot Jill's exact route. It was on Tuesday, the 25th of September, that investigators released to the public the Dutch's boutique footage, the key video showing Jill walking north along Sydney Road around 1:41 a.m. and that man in the blue hoodie stepping into view to speak with her. Detectives appealed directly to that man and to anyone else who recognised themselves on the footage to come forward.
We hold grave concerns for Jill.
Is it growing?
Well, she hasn't been heard of since the early hours of Saturday morning, and it's now Wednesday. She hasn't accessed her bank records since that time. There's been no word from her mobile phone, and with all the media coverage on this, we do hold great concerns for her welfare. We're still undergoing forensic testing on the handbag, and we'll continue to pursue that. I will say that we are adopting a methodical approach to this investigation. We need to get it right. We need to make sure that everything we do is appropriate and that it gives us the best possible evidence, because ultimately we want to find out what happened to Jill.
Within hours, the images led every major television bulletin in Australia and dominated radio news. The footage was replayed across RTE, BBC News, amongst other media outlets, carrying Jill's story back to her hometown of Drogheda. On social media, the impact was immediate. Friends created a Help Us Find Jill Maher Facebook page, which gathered more than 120,000 followers within days, an unprecedented level of public engagement at the time. Comments poured in offering search help, theories, and messages of support for Tom and the McKeown family. The Sydney Road community rallied around the search. Local shop owners reviewed their own security footage and handed copies to police. Residents organised small walking searches through nearby lanes and parks. People who had been out that night contacted detectives to confirm their movements, including one man who recognised himself in the CCTV walking just ahead of Jill and came forward to assist investigators. By midweek, the street itself had changed. Flowers, candles and handwritten notes began appearing near the Duchess boutique window and along the shop fronts where Jill had last been seen. Someone taped up a sign that read simply, "Bring Jill home." Strangers stopped to lay bouquets, light candles or talk quietly about the case. For many in Melbourne, the search for Jill had become personal. She was no longer just a missing name on the news, but a woman whose story felt heartbreakingly familiar. By midweek, the case was no longer a routine missing persons report. The homicide squad formally took command, working out of the Brunswick Police Station and the Victoria Police Major Command Centre. Detective Inspector John Potter and later Detective Inspector Stephen Lean coordinated the investigation, pulling in analysts, forensic officers and missing persons specialists. A dedicated team was assigned to review more than 600 hours of CCTV footage gathered from every business and tram stop along Sydney Road. Detectives worked in shifts, pinning still frames to boards that mapped Jill's last known movements, minute by minute. Specialists examined tram stop CCTV, phone tower pings and public transport data to narrow the data between 1:40 a.m. and 1:45 a.m. The narrow window in which Jill had vanished. The handbag found off Hope Street had been processed for fingerprints and trace evidence. Forensic officers combed the laneway and nearby alleys with ultraviolet lights and collection kits. The forensic lab in Macleod began analysing fibres and soil samples taken from the bag's surface. As detectives continued reviewing footage, they noticed a dark-coloured Holden Commodore appearing multiple times near Sydney Road, around the time Jill disappeared. The car was seen turning onto side streets close to Hope Street, shortly after 1:40 a.m. Although the number plate wasn't clear, the vehicle's movements did stand out. Behind the scenes, the homicide squad began checking every registered blue Holden Commodore in the surrounding suburbs, cross-referencing ownership details and known offenders. It was a painstaking task, but it would later prove crucial to identifying their suspect. While the technical work continued, Tom Maher faced the public strain of keeping Jill's name in the news. He fronted media briefings outside the couple's apartment, his appeals calm but direct. "If anyone knows anything, please come forward." Reporters noted his composure and the steady support of friends and colleagues who stood beside him. For Jill's family in Drogheda, it was a blur of midnight calls across time zones. Her brother Michael acted as a link between Victoria Police and their parents, George and Edith, who waited for updates from Ireland while news bulletins replayed the same short CCTV clip over and over. Public interest had reached levels rarely seen in Australia at the time. Radio stations interrupted programming with updates. Newspapers printed maps of Sydney Road. Twitter feeds shared possible sightings within minutes of each police release. Volunteers organised nighttime walks to retrace Jill's route, determined to keep the search visible. By Thursday, the city felt suspended between hope and dread. Posters covered nearly every pole from Victoria Street to Moorland Road. In cafe windows, handwritten signs read, "Bring Jill home." Outside the Duchess Boutique, flowers spread along the footpath and strangers lingered to leave notes or light candles. For investigators, every piece of new footage brought the picture into sharper focus. They could now trace Jill almost step by step until her phone signal cut out near Hope Street. The evidence pointed to a specific few hundred metres of roadway, a short, familiar stretch that had suddenly become the centre of an enormous investigation. For Tom, these were the longest days of his life. Each evening he returned to a flat that was too quiet, answering messages from reporters and from people offering prayers, while police called with updates that were factual but rarely hopeful. The week ended with a community standing shoulder to shoulder with a family. A city watching the same grainy footage, united by the same question. What happened in those missing minutes on Sydney Road? The investigation now had its focus. All it needed was a breakthrough. The breakthrough came late on Wednesday, the 26th of September 2012. Detectives had spent days piecing together footage from dozens of cameras, small convenience stores, tram stops and traffic lights, trying to follow Jill's path and the people around her in those last minutes. When the clips were lined up in sequence, the pattern was clear. At 1:41 a.m, Jill was seen walking north along Sydney Road, passing the Duchess Boutique. Moments later, the man in the blue hoodie appeared beside her. The two seemed to exchange a few words before continuing north together for a short distance. From another camera angle further up the street, detectives saw the same man walking back alone. His stride was quicker now, his posture different. Jill was no longer in view. The timing between frames left little room for doubt. Something had happened in those missing minutes. Working backwards, investigators tracked the man's movements across multiple CCTV feeds along Sydney Road, from Victoria Street up towards Hope Street. He appeared outside several late-night businesses, walking the same stretch more than once, always wearing that blue hoodie. At around 1:40 a.m, he was seen near Hope Street, moments before approaching Jill. Minutes later, another camera captured him heading back in the opposite way, alone. Detectives would later learn that earlier he had visited a sex worker in Brunswick. After leaving, he drove his blue Holden Commodore towards Sydney Road and parked near Hope Street. CCTV showed him walking up and down the footpath for several minutes, apparently loitering and watching passers-by. He appeared calm and deliberate, waiting for an opportunity. When analysts widened their review to include traffic and shop cameras on the adjoining streets, a dark-coloured Holden Commodore sedan began turning up repeatedly near the same locations. As I said, the registration plate was partially blurred, but enhancement recovered enough characteristics to narrow the list. Investigators again cross-checked those partial numbers against vehicle databases. By Wednesday afternoon, one name stood out. Adrian Ernest Bailey, age 41, from Coburg. The match fit every detail. Bailey was known to police for previous violent offences, including multiple rapes, and had been released on parole in 2011. He lived only a few kilometres from Brunswick, well within reach of Sydney Road. Detectives confirmed through parole records that the Blue Commodore was registered to him. The atmosphere inside the Major Crime Command Centre shifted instantly. After days of uncertainty, they finally had a clear lead, a face, a name, and a vehicle. Surveillance officers were dispatched to confirm his whereabouts. When they saw the car parked outside his home, the decision was made. At about 8 p.m, teams from the Homicide Squad and Sexual Crimes Unit converged on Bailey's house on Ballarat Road, Coburg. He was arrested without incident and taken to the St Kilda Road Police Complex for questioning. At that stage, Jill was still officially listed as a missing person, though detectives privately feared the worst. Inside the interview room that night, Bailey was questioned by two senior homicide detectives. The interview began at 9:30 p.m. and continued into the early hours of the morning. At first, he denied ever seeing or speaking to Jill Marr, claiming he had been at home in Coburg all night. When detectives confronted him with still images from the Duchess Boutique CCTV, showing him clearly beside Jill, he changed his account. He said he had maybe spoken to her briefly, but insisted she had walked off unharmed. As the interview went on, police played additional footage showing him returning alone down Sydney Road. They also presented forensic updates about the Holden Commodore, which had been seen in the area and registered to him. Bailey's story shifted again. He admitted approaching Jill and said he had tried to chat her up, but claimed she had become angry and slapped him. He then alleged that an argument broke out and that he had pushed her. Detectives pressed further, pointing out inconsistencies and gaps in his timeline. They reminded him that his criminal record included multiple violent sexual assaults and that the evidence, CCTV, phone data and witness statements, was building against him. Over the next few hours, his demeanour reportedly changed from defensive to resigned. In the early hours of Thursday, the 27th of September 2012, Bailey finally confessed. He told police he had followed Jill along Hope Street, grabbed her from behind and forced her into a side laneway. There he raped her. When she screamed and threatened to report him, he said he strangled her in panic. After strangling Jill, Bailey left her body in the laneway, walked back to his parked car nearby, then returned, lifted her into the boot and drove north out of Melbourne. He stopped briefly at his home in Coburg to change clothes and collect a shovel before continuing to Gisborne South, where he buried her in a shallow grave off Black Hill Road. Bailey drew a rough map for detectives, marking the location near Black Hill Road, where he said he had buried her in a shallow grave. His detailed directions led police to the site within hours. By dawn, the confession had been recorded in full, witnessed and signed. Detectives ended the session with the grim confirmation that Jill Marr was no longer missing. She had been murdered. The area was immediately sealed off when officers located the grave in the early hours of Thursday, the 27th of September 2012. It was a lonely stretch of country road near Gisborne South, lined with gum trees and scrubland. Police vehicles blocked the entrances while the Forensic Services Department set up portable lighting and evidence tents. Under the glare of floodlights, forensic teams worked through the night, photographing tire marks, footprints and disturbed soil. They recovered personal items and clothing later confirmed to belong to Jill. Her body was carefully removed just before dawn, transported to the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine in Melbourne for a full post-mortem examination. Detectives on scene radioed through to the headquarters in St Kilda Road, where senior officers briefed Detective Inspector Stephen Lean, who had overseen the investigation from the start. Around 6:30 a.m, confirmation came that the remains were consistent with those of Jill Marr. At roughly the same time, a small team of officers was dispatched to Tom Marr's apartment in Luxway, Brunswick, to deliver the news in person. Tom's father-in-law, George McKeown, and brother-in-law, Michael, were contacted in Ireland. Police liaison officers were assigned to the family in both countries to provide updates and support. Shortly after 7 a.m, Detective Inspector Lean faced a bank of microphones outside Victoria Police Headquarters. His voice was quiet but steady as he confirmed the development. A man is in custody and a body believed to be that of Jill Marr has been located near Gisborne South. He added that formal identification was still pending, but the police believed they had found the woman who had been missing for nearly a week. He praised the public's cooperation and the work of the investigators who had spent 6 days tracing every step of her final journey. As news broke, television networks cut into programming to carry the announcement live. Within minutes, social media filled with messages of sorrow and disbelief. The Help Us Find Jill Marr Facebook page, which only a day earlier had been filled with hopeful search updates, became a memorial space. Comments came from across Ireland and Australia. Messages of condolences for Tom and her family and tributes to Jill herself. At the scene near Gisborne South, the investigation continued through daylight. Detectives measured the site, took casts of the footprints and marked evidence with flags. The grave was shallow, about 30 centimetres deep, shielded by low scrub and a small embankment that made it invisible from the road. Police said later that without Bailey's detailed directions, it might never have been found. By mid-morning, the road had been reopened, but the atmosphere in Melbourne had shifted completely. The search that had united tens of thousands of people had ended not in a rescue, but in grief. Bailey appeared in the Melbourne Magistrates Court later that day. The hearing was brief. He was charged with rape and murder and remanded in custody. The courtroom was packed. Outside, members of the public gathered silently behind barriers. In the days that followed, tributes multiplied. Hundreds of people left flowers outside the Duchess Boutique and along Sydney Road, which by then had become a kind of memorial walkway. Handwritten notes expressed sorrow, anger and solidarity with Jill's family and with Tom. On Monday, the 1st of October 2012, more than 30,000 people took part in a silent march along Sydney Road in Jill's memory. The procession began at Brunswick Baptist Church and ended near Moreland Road, close to where she was last seen. There were no speeches, no chants, only the sound of footsteps. It was one of the largest public gatherings Melbourne has ever seen. As the investigation moved into the court process, disturbing details of Adrian Bailey's past came to light. Reporters covering his first appearance in the Melbourne Magistrates Court on the 27th of September 2012 noted that the charge sheet listed not only murder but rape, and that prosecutors described him as a high-risk violent offender. Over the weeks that followed, it emerged that Bailey had a long history of sexual violence dating back nearly 2 decades. His first conviction for rape was in 2000, when he attacked 5 women in Geelong over a period of 6 months. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison for those offences, but served just over 5 years before being released on parole. In 2008, only 2 years after his release, he was again convicted of assaulting a man outside a bar in Geelong and received another term of imprisonment. Despite repeated warnings from psychologists about his high risk of reoffending, Bailey was granted parole again in 2011. At the time of Jill Marr's murder in September 2012, Bailey was living under that parole order. He was required to report regularly to a parole officer, a condition that, in hindsight, would be heavily scrutinised. When those facts became public, the reaction in Australia was one of shock and anger. Editorials questioned how a man with such a record could have been free. The Victorian government ordered an urgent review of the parole system, led by retired judge Ian Callanan QC, to examine how violent and sexual offenders were being monitored. The review found that the Adult Parole Board had failed to fully consider Bailey's escalating risk. He had breached parole conditions several times, including being charged with assault in 2011, but was allowed to remain in the community. The report described the system as reactive rather than preventative and led to major reforms in 2013 and 2014. These included stricter parole eligibility tests, new supervision categories, and automatic cancellation of parole for serious offenders who reoffended. For Jill's family and for the public, the revelations were deeply unsettling. What had begun as a shocking but isolated tragedy now appeared as a systemic failure. Commentators describe Bailey as a man who should never have been free to walk the streets. The fallout was far-reaching. The Victorian government introduced new laws giving police greater powers to track high-risk sex offenders and the ministerial oversight for violent crimes. In the media and public conversation, Jill's name became synonymous with the demand for a safer, more accountable system. Jill's funeral took place in her hometown of Drogheda on Friday, the 12th of October 2012, at the Church of Our Lady of Lourdes. Her coffin was carried by family and friends, followed by Tom and her parents, George and Edith, and her brother Michael. She was later cremated at Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin, surrounded by family. In April 2013, Adrian Bailey appeared before the Supreme Court of Victoria and pleaded guilty to the rape and murder of Jill Marr. His plea meant that there would be no trial. Instead, the court heard an agreed summary of the facts outlining how he had stalked and attacked Jill at random as she walked home alone on the night of the 21st into the 22nd of September 2012. The prosecution told the court that Jill had done nothing to provoke or engage Bailey. She had simply been walking along the road when he approached her. The attack was described as opportunistic and unprovoked, carried out by a man with a known history of violence. Bailey admitted to grabbing her from behind, dragging her into a laneway off Hope Street and raping her before strangling her when she screamed and threatened to report him. The courtroom was silent as the details were read aloud. Prosecutors emphasised the cruelty of the act and Bailey's deliberate attempt to conceal the crime, returning to collect his car, placing her body in the boot and burying her 50 kilometres away in Gisborne South. Jill's family, including her husband Tom and her parents George and Edith and brother Michael, were present. They listened as the court was told of Bailey's lengthy criminal record, his parole status, and the repeated failures of the system to contain his violent behaviour. When Justice Geoffrey Nettle delivered his sentencing remarks on the 19th of June 2013, he spoke directly to the gravity of what had been done. He described the crime as callous and despicable in the extreme, noting that Jill had been an innocent young woman on her way home and that Bailey had shown no mercy and no remorse at the time. Justice Nettle went on to recount Bailey's past convictions, the long history of sexual violence against women, and said it was clear that rehabilitation was an illusion. He told Bailey, "You left her there in that laneway with her dignity destroyed and her life extinguished for no reason other than your own gratification. The community is entitled to be protected from you for as long as possible." Bailey was sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum non-parole period of 35 years. The judge made it plain that even after those 35 years, release would not be automatic and would depend entirely on the parole board's assessment of risk. Outside court, Tom Marr faced the press with quiet dignity. The case had dominated headlines for months and hundreds of journalists had gathered on the steps of the Supreme Court of Victoria to hear his reaction. Cameras clicked as he stepped forward holding a prepared statement written in his own hand. He began by thanking the people who had stood by them, the police who had worked tirelessly to solve the case, the community in Melbourne who had organised searches and vigils, and those in Ireland who had sent messages of comfort. "It's been the darkest time," he said, "but we've been held up by kindness, from friends, from strangers, from both sides of the world." He spoke briefly about Jill, her warmth, her humour, her empathy, and said that the past months had shown him how deeply she had touched others. He made a point of saying that neither he nor Jill's family wanted her remembered solely for the way she died, but for how she lived. When asked about the sentence, his voice tightened. Jill's life was worth more than 35 years, he said. No sentence will ever bring her back. But if there's anything to be taken from this, it's that people came together. That's what Jill would have wanted. Compassion, not hate. He declined to take further questions, thanked the media and stepped away, surrounded by family and close friends. Reporters noted how composed he seemed, though the grief in his face was unmistakable. The words resonated deeply in both countries. In Ireland, newspapers carried the statement on front pages beside photos of the couple smiling together. In Melbourne, radio hosts replayed the clip throughout the day, describing it as an example of grace in the face of devastation. In the weeks that followed, Tom spoke more openly about the wider issues the case had exposed. In interviews, he criticised what he called the toxic culture of male entitlement that allowed violence against women to persist, and he urged people to challenge it in their own lives. Those comments were later cited in public campaigns about gendered violence and respect. For many, Tom's restraint and clarity after such loss became a defining part of Jill's legacy. His decision to speak about kindness rather than anger shaped how both Ireland and Australia remembered her story as a tragedy that brought people together rather than divided them. In the years since, Jill's name has remained a point of remembrance in both countries. The Silent March is still recalled as a symbol of collective empathy, and her case became a catalyst for changes to Victoria's parole and violent offenders supervision laws. What began as a late night walk home, something absolutely ordinary, familiar and safe, ended as one of the most significant criminal cases in modern Australian history. Jill Maher's story is still told today, not only for its tragedy, but for the compassion it drew out of people and for the conversations it forced about safety, justice and change. After the sentencing in 2013, Tom remained in Melbourne for a time. He occasionally spoke at public events addressing violence against women, focusing on prevention rather than punishment. Beyond the legal reforms, Jill's story sparked a wider conversation about violence against women. Radio stations, universities and community organisations hosted public forums. Campaigns such as Our Watch and White Ribbon Australia began using Jill's case as a turning point. Proof that change could not come from tougher sentences alone, but from confronting the culture that allowed violence to grow. One of the most powerful voices in that conversation was Tom Maher. After the sentencing, he spoke rarely, but when he did, it was with extraordinary clarity. In 2014, he wrote an article for The Guardian Australia titled "The Simple Truth About Violence Against Women." It was published on the UN International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, and within days, it had been read hundreds of thousands of times. "Violence against women doesn't come from nowhere," he wrote. "It begins long before a punch is thrown or a life is taken." He urged men to take responsibility for changing the attitudes that enable harm. "Men must stop treating violence against women as if it's someone else's problem. It's our problem. It's on us to challenge it, to call it out and to change it." Tom reflected on how in the months after Jill's murder, people kept asking why she had been walking alone. His response was blunt. The question shouldn't be why she was alone. It should be, why are some men violent? He explained that violence exists on a spectrum, from casual disrespect to physical aggression, and that society too often ignores those early signs. "Every time we laugh off harassment or ignore controlling behaviour, we make space for the next act of violence. It's the same line, it's only a matter of how far it's crossed," he wrote. The piece was reprinted and shared worldwide. Advocacy groups cited it in education programmes, and journalists in Ireland and Australia called it one of the clearest statements ever written by someone who had lived through the consequences. He closed with words that have since been quoted in classrooms and campaigns. If Jill's death can mean anything, let it mean that we refuse to be silent. Let it mean that men start listening, speaking up and changing. After publishing that essay, Tom gradually stepped away from public attention. He has lived a quieter life, dividing time between Ireland and Australia, still supporting anti-violence initiatives, but largely staying out of view. Those who have met him since say his focus remains on empathy and prevention, on ensuring that Jill's death leads to understanding, not bitterness.
Tom, thank you so much for speaking to us today. I can't possibly imagine what it's been like for you over the past year. Can you tell us, can you give us any idea of how you've coped?
Well, the past year has kind of been kind of a succession of just coming to terms with massively different things. I mean, obviously my life has completely and utterly changed in a matter of one night. It's just been support and family and friends that have really pulled me through and are still pulling me through this, and nobody's given up on me for a second throughout this whole thing. So it's been fantastic in that way, but obviously still really painful.
Now, just casting your mind back before the reasons that we're here today to Jill, if I was to meet Jill, say, 2 years ago, what sort of person would I have met?
You would have met, you would have met the funniest girl in the world. Sorry. Excuse me. She's incredibly funny and incredibly witty and just so smart and intelligent that she just brightened up any room she was in. It took ages to kind of tear, separate my memories of her from what happened to her, you know? So it's kind of, I love to think about her, but it's often very intrusive and something will just pop into your head and, you know, it comes out of nowhere. And then it's difficult to separate, but it's worth it to try. It's worth it to remember Jill. So that's what I try to do. It's never over until you finally see that monster gone, you know? So, hopefully I can just cut him out of my life, and of course he'll always be there, but I mean, I don't want him there. So I want to think of Jill. I don't want to think of him.
Today, more than a decade later, Jill Maher's story continues to resonate. Her name is often invoked in discussions about parole reform, community safety, and respect for women. Each year on social media, people still post her photo with messages of remembrance. Let's keep the streets safe for Jill. Her legacy is not just in the changes to law or policy, but in the compassion she inspired. A tragedy that began on an ordinary street corner became a movement for change and awareness in Melbourne, in Ireland, and far beyond.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto-download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.